much like the bourgeoisie of the previous era. During this time, the call to abolish the family took two forms. Kollontai's efforts to collectivize reproductive labor during the Russian Civil War, and queer and feminists revolting against the suburban family in the 1960s. Since the decline of the workers' movement, capitalist crises has again transformed family life, making the working class male breadwinner family impossible for the majority of proletarians. To understand the first era and the meaning of the demand to abolish the family meant by Marx and Engels, let's go back to the manifesto. On what foundation is the present family, the bourgeois family, based? On capital, on private gain. In its completely developed form, this family exists only amongst the bourgeoisie. But this state of things finds its complement in the practical absence of the family among the proletarians and in public prostitution. This first era, prior to the rise of the workers' movement, extends from mass industrialization in Germany and England in the 1830s until the 1890s. This was the period that Marx and Engels were theorizing. During this time, capitalism was destroying peasant family life and undermining any possibility of proletarians to constitute new, stable family structures. In Europe, this took the form of Engels documented in The Condition of the English Working Class, where factory work by children, wage labor in the home by mothers, and the condition of extreme poverty were destroying the working class family. In the US and Caribbean, capitalism undermined working class family life in another very different way, through the conditions of slavery, where subjugation as property made it impossible for enslaved black people to build stable and enduring family structures. However, key features of working class family life began to change in the 1880s and 1890s, driven by capitalist competition, capitalist development, and the rising organization of workers' struggles. In the 1890s, we see in Germany and England the rise and institutionalization of a new workers' movement. This movement, in alliance with bourgeois reformers, won the material conditions for new forms of stability for the upper tier of the working class. They won the opportunity for a new characteristic family structure, modeled closely after the bourgeoisie they both despised and yearned to emulate: a single male wage earner, an unwaged wife on whom all household reproductive labor fell, and their children enrolled in public school. The tenets of working class respectability became isolated single-family housing, male domination within the home, and severing material dependence on other families. Meanwhile, in the United States, with the defeat of Black Reconstruction, sharecropping imposed an intensely brutal heterosexual family norm onto Black people. Landlords required sharecroppers to marry in order to lease land, and denied them the land if they chose to separate. Black marriage was enforced by the Jim Crow system. I offer two quotes to illustrate the tensions and debates around family norms produced within the socialist movement. The first is from Karl Kautsky, key leader and theorist of the German Social Democratic Party and the Second International. He summarizes the newfound family conservatism of the socialist movement. Quote, "One of the most widespread prejudices against socialism rests upon the notion that it proposes to abolish the family. No socialist has the remotest idea of abolishing the family. That is, legally and forcibly dissolving it. Only the grossest misrepresentation can fasten upon socialism any such intention." In contrast, we can look to the efforts of Alexander Kollontai and women in the Russian Revolutionary Civil War in collectivizing reproductive labor through food canteens, childcare centers, seeking to eliminate unwaged reproductive labor in order to eliminate gender equality, open onto true love, and proletarianize women into the workforce. Kollontai says, quote, "The individual household is dying. It is giving way in our society to collective housekeeping. In place of the old relationship between men and women, a new one is developing, a union of affection and comradeship, a union of two equal members of communist society, both of them free, both of them independent, and both of them workers. There's a great deal to say about this, and proletarianization is really essential to mass, universal proletarianization is essential to the workers' movement, and the contradictions of subjugation and equality involved in that, which I don't have time to get into at the moment. At the end of the workers' movement, the family form of the male breadwinner family came under direct assault by radical feminists, queers, and black women. They rebelled against a set of family norms and institutions exemplified by the suburban, heterosexual, isolated, patriarchal family form. Through a series of struggles in gay liberation, women's liberation, welfare rights, and black power, they fought for greater sexual pleasure, gender freedom, and experimented with radically different chosen family forms. As an example, here's a quote from the Manifesto of Third World Gay Revolution in 1970. "We want the abolition of the institution of the bourgeois nuclear family. We believe that the bourgeois nuclear family perpetuates the false categories of homosexuality and heterosexuality by creating sex roles, sex definitions, and sexual exploitation." The crisis of profitability over production and surplus populations that brought an end to the workers' movement in the mid-1970s also brought the end to the working class male breadwinner. Stagnant wages have made it increasingly impossible for any sector of the working class to raise a family on a single wage. And working class people marry later and less often, pursue queer relationships more often, co-parent in non-romantic partnerships, or find other ways of surviving without the male breadwinner family. Yet this has come at a cost, the new universalization of the tyranny of the wage and the market, the increasing atomization of private life. Recently, the demand to abolish the family has reemerged in queer, Marxist, trans-communist, and Marxist-feminist thinking, including by a number of excellent speakers at this year's HM conference, such as Sophie Lewis, Kate Doyle Griffiths, and Jules Gleason. New insurrectionary communist collective networks of reproduction could, in a revolutionary struggle, replace the market, the family, and the state as a material basis for survival, and also as an effective source of care, love, and erotic pleasure. Here, the positive supersession of the family is the preservation and emancipation of genuine love, of the genuine love and care proletarian people have found with each other in the midst of hardship. The fun and joy of eroticism and good sex, the intimacy of parenting and romance, freed from the rigid social roles of heteronormative gender and sexual identity, the material constraints of capitalism, and remade in the intensity of revolutionary struggle, the potential of love and care can finally be freed up onto the world. The abolition of the family must be the positive creation of a society of generalized human care and queer love. So here's my chart mapping my periodization that I thought would be far too dull to organize a presentation around, but I made handouts. So in the Q&A of this chart, if you are trying to make sense of a dense argument, the chart could be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michelle. And now Justin is going to talk about his article called Revolutionary Motives.
Great, thanks. Thanks everyone for coming. Yeah, I wanted to say that about the kind of timing of endnotes, I've always thought of it sort of like if people have read Heinrich Grossman and his theory of capitalist crisis, he proves that if you given a certain set of accounts or whatever, in 25 years a kind of crisis will happen, but then he tells you, well, a year isn't really a year, it could be like 50 real years. So that's sort of like the way an issue, the distance between 4 and 5, you know, issue 4 and 5 is variable. It could be anywhere from, 6 months to 1,000 years. The essay I'm gonna read, the kind of introduction that sort of lays out in boldface some of the claims of this article. I sort of, in the introduction, I make a bunch of incredibly tendentious points that always get me in trouble, and people kind of react to them, and they're like, this can't be right. And then I spend the rest of the essay sort of dodging bullets. And by the end, I think people feel very satisfied, but I'm just gonna read you the tendentious part today. Why do the dispossessed revolt? Or more to the point, why don't they? There's no shortage of reasons. In every direction we look, the fully capitalist world presents itself as an immense accumulation of injury and outrage. And yet, on their own, these reasons rarely suffice as explanation. What is unbearable to one group of proletarians is bearable to another. What produces a rebellion on one occasion or in one place fails to elicit any response on another. We might be tempted to approach the problem from the other side and list all the reasons not to revolt, chief among them the enormous repressive power of the state. Most revolts end in failure, even if we define success in the most modest terms. And failure means, let's be clear, not only wasted effort, but injury, death, imprisonment. Except in situations where survival is truly at stake, there's always good reason to keep one's head down, to stagger on under the nightmare weight of history. But fear explains both too much and too little, since many do revolt in situations when the odds are not particularly good and the risks great. At a first pass, we are confronted by an insufficient positive explanation, reasons for, and an insufficient negative one, reasons against. Moreover, as nearly all commentators have noticed, since the odds of success for a revolt are not determined by the force of the enemy alone, but by the number of those who participate, there is something circular and self-fulfilling about whatever judgments participants make about the risks. Bad odds can be transformed into good ones if, by misapprehending the situation or ignoring the risks, some small group decides to go ahead anyway, creating felicitous conditions for everyone else. A leap into the void can make the ground appear, just as a refusal to leap can turn solid ground to thinnest air. The self-fulfilling character of such judgment has led many pro-revolutionaries to conclude that the decisive element is the consciousness of would-be rebels, who must be educated or provided with the right leadership in order to realize the reasonableness of revolt, the possibility of success given unitary action. This view, which I will call voluntarist, finds its most important articulation in the words of Karl Kautsky, as interpreted and popularized by Vladimir Lenin in What Is to Be Done. Socialist consciousness, writes Kautsky, is something introduced into the proletarian class struggle from without, and not something that arose within it spontaneously. For Lenin, this position necessitates the formation of cadres of professional revolutionaries who can provide intellectual leadership to the working class, lest their default to a spontaneous trade union consciousness leave them incapable of effectively combating their domination by capital. We might think of Lenin's interpretation of the voluntarist thesis as pastoral, meaning it emphasizes leadership. Other voluntarisms are pedagogical. So there's two types of voluntarism, a pastoral and a pedagogical. At one point I called pastoral authoritarian, but then that sounded, you know, just too, had too much kind of anarchist baggage. So pastoral is like, pastoral in the sense of not in like going out to the countryside and like, you know, leading sheep around, but in the sense of caring for the flock, the old idea of the pastor as a kind of a tender of the flock. So, you know, it's a different idea of leadership. It doesn't necessarily, you know, it doesn't have to be violent, but often is. Other voluntarisms are pedagogical, identifying the education of the underclasses as the decisive element. Antonio Gramsci may be the clearest exemplar of this latter variant, but it should be noted that voluntarists are rarely pastoral or pedagogical completely. We can talk here only of tendencies. Lenin's professional revolutionaries were to sell newspapers in order to develop close contact with the masses they might later mobilize, and Gramsci himself continuously describes education as a form of leadership. Most voluntarists acknowledge that revolt does occur independently of pastoral or pedagogical intervention. A certain class of revolt, riot, or strike is more or less spontaneous, reflexive, and unexplainable, except as the result of contingency, our pedagogues or would-be leaders might say. But more massive, durable, open-ended, and strategic revolt depends, in their estimation, on consciousness and leadership. The voluntarist account of spontaneous action must therefore be distinguished from what I call fatalism. For the fatalist, spontaneity goes all the way down, and there is no way to cheat through the process through acts of will. Fatalists see revolt as unfolding from either inexorable objective mechanisms or perhaps the advent of an ineffable event. Why do people revolt? Let me tell you, say the pastor and the pedagogues. We just don't know, say the fatalists. Declaring something unknowable is always a safe approach. But as I will argue below, political struggles often require people to make assumptions about the motivations of others. In revolutions, such assumptions can prove quite powerful. Indeed, as I show, the pedagogical and pastoral assumptions are at the heart of the processes that allow revolution to turn to counter-revolution. So this is kind of a bold-faced claim. This argument is that, you know, the pedagogical and the pastoral have really, you know, deleterious consequences for the unfolding of revolution. Those who say they don't know now may find themselves at a practical, intuitive level, relying upon common sense conceptions later on. Obviously, there is a great deal within history that is unknowable. We may never be able to say why, for instance, the murder by the police of a young unarmed man in one instance produces a riot, and in the other, nothing more than a few small protests. But we may be able to say something about why the riot continues, dies down, or passes over into insurrection. To do so, we need a theory of revolutionary motives. The pedagogical and pastoral approaches fail because they confuse people's motives with people's beliefs. Motives, for the most part, and especially revolutionary motives, exist at a deeper level than the sort of consciousness or ideology that pedagogues and authorities can target. Survival, desire for increased well-being, concern for the well-being of one's familiars, hatred of oppressive heteronomy. These motives do not need to be taught, even if they are conditioned and transformed by social structure, nor can they be untaught. For an ideology to succeed, it must work with and not against people's underlying motivations. My use of the term motives is more or less identical to the concept of interests, though I conceive of interest as broader than self-interest as such, and will use the term motive when I want to mark some distance from simple egoism and the utilitarian anthropology that has placed it at the center of any theory of human motivation. I will occasionally use the term materialist when referring to the basic motives described above, that is, concern for material well-being, though it should be noted that such concern extends to dependents, companions, and intimates. Within Marxist and other left thought, interests name the deep, though often unexplained, forces that mobilize the underclasses. An interest, importantly, is something more than a reflexive action, something other than instinct or drive as such. We use the term to name internal forces that can be repressed or ignored, that appear as strong inclination or felt need, that motivate action but do not immediately produce it, and that therefore prompt deliberation or reflection. Motive is perhaps similar to what Baruch Spinoza has called kinetis, or striving. Each thing, Spinoza writes famously, as far as it can by its own power, strives to persevere in its being. This being in which people strive to persevere is not identical for every person, and some aspects of it are quite clearly, historically determined, unique to particular social relations and institutions. But every society or human community has as its given that it must allow people to survive, if not flourish. And the motives that correspond to these survival needs will form the basis for much, though certainly not all, of what people do. Humans will strive to feed themselves, to find shelter from the elements, and to avoid pain and illness, to speak of three of the most basic material motives. In capitalism, these basic motives fuel the fires of accumulation. The apparatus of the wage, for example, depends upon the motivated yet free action of proletarians who, dispossessed of the means of production, voluntarily sell their labor power in order to survive. Proletarians are not gripped by capital at a neuromuscular level, their bodies directly recruited to produce things of value. Not yet, at least. Maybe they're developing that somewhere down at the Google offices down the street. Domination and power is everywhere, and its history thousands of years deep, but people are almost never the simple objects or tools of others. Even those forms of domination, which we imagine to operate almost entirely through force and to be more or less indifferent to the consent of the dominated, presume some limited margin of freedom. Prisons are constructed and organized, for example, on the assumption that prisoners will try to escape, and even plantation slavery, which seems in some regards the infernal maximum of dehumanizing and objectifying oppression, presupposed that slaves were free to refuse work, attempt to escape, revolt. Hence its recourse to violent punishment at every turn as necessary compulsion. It should be made clear that a theory of revolutionary motives is not a theory of motives in general. People are no doubt driven all by all manner of unique, perverse, and complex desires, understanding of which must be left to psychology, if not psychoanalysis. Since we are talking of inclination rather than instinct, motive and interest are probabilistic concepts. Rather than seeking to explain every single thing that people do, interest is similar to the Marxian concept of tendency, asserting itself in the long run and in the aggregate, despite and against deviation. So I don't need to tell you why everybody does everything. I just need to set some kind of guidelines. Thank God. A theory of revolutionary motives is concerned with proletarian interests that are basic, common, and elemental. Revolutions have a tendency to bring these elemental motives to the surface because survival is so often at stake and because they aggregate many actors, thus putting into question what they have in common as goals. Furthermore, because they involve the breakdown of existing institutions, people can no longer rely on habit or commonplace rubrics, and instead must elaborate through deliberation and collective conversation new ways of doing things based on motives. So basically what I'm saying is there's other explanations for why people do things, habit, desire, etc. I'm not saying those are wrong, I'm just saying that they tell you about a kind of different class of things than the one that I'm interested in. The theory of revolutionary motives therefore emphasizes the practical reasoning that inhabits the gap between compulsion and action. In revolutionary situations, proletarians reflect on what they are doing. They do not simply act instinctively. The concept of reason will no doubt sound the alarm for some readers, trained by various anti-humanisms and structuralisms to see people as character masks for impersonal forces. Many have critiqued the Marxian theory of interest as universalizing a Western or post-Enlightenment philosophy of mind, and there is little doubt that certain presentations of it naturalize a limited and ultimately European psychology. But reason and rationality are not the same thing. To suggest that people think about what they do is not the same thing as suggesting that they are utility-maximizing computers or vessels for transcendental faculties. Reason can be irrational by the lights of an Immanuel Kant or Karl Popper, and when it comes to social practice, what matters is that it works, not that it's correct. So I'm still using reason if I think that, you know, I will cast a spell and cause somebody to die. That's reasoning. It may not be rational according to some people, but it's reason. In any case, capitalism is now a global phenomenon, and capitalism is, as indicated above, nothing if not a form of unfreedom that acts through reasoned choice, through a paper-thin freedom, constraining and limiting the autonomy of the exploited. Capitalism presupposes the theory of motives advanced here. Where there is reasoning, there are also ideas, and though voluntarists overemphasize the role of ideas, consciousness, and ideology, this is not to say that ideas are inconsequential, nor that there is no role whatsoever for a theory of ideology. So, I mean, part of this, what I'm doing is I'm trying to kind of right-size ideology, which I think has become this kind of overweening explanation for everything, and I think it really hinders our ability to understand why revolutions do or do not happen. So I kind of hate the theory of ideology, but I'm not going to say it doesn't exist. I just think it needs to be right-sized. Inasmuch as proletarians reflect on what they do, then ideas will play a role in the actions they take, since evaluating the consequences of one's actions depends upon ideas about how the world functions. This is also well described by Spinoza, both insofar as the mind has clear and distinct ideas, and insofar as it has confused ideas, it strives for an indefinite duration to persevere in its being, and it is conscious of the striving it has. In other words, contrary to the assumptions of voluntarist theory, ideology is significant in as much as it conditions what people do, but it has little effect on the deeper underlying motives. The motives we are concerned with here are either givens or social reproduction, which is to say, like, you can't ideologize people to not want to eat. I mean, you can, but maybe not over the long term and in the aggregate, right? The motives we are concerned with here are either givens of social reproduction or products of social structures that are unchangeable without a change of structure. They exist at a deeper level than the sort of consciousness or ideology which pedagogues and leaders aim to transform. You cannot unteach hunger. Many will no doubt want to know why it matters that we know why people do these things. The answer is that, in any revolution, there was always the formation of a dedicated and organized mass whose motives are, in some regard, idiosyncratic, undertaken out of commitment to the cause of the revolution rather than personal well-being or the well-being of familiars. Wingnuts, weirdos, the people who are in this room. Many of the people who write and read texts such as this one, author included, will likely find themselves in this weird class of people whose motives and desires are no doubt various and deserve study in their own right. This is a porous zone, and I think the other essay in Endnotes is going to kind of explain the, like, you know, this is where we need psychoanalysis and string theory and an understanding of the, you know, derivatives. And this is a porous zone into which and from which people pass in and out, and certainly not exclusive of other more basic motives. Some may engage in struggle for basic reasons and stay for other ones, and needless to say, such motives can reappear and trump all, such as when a person threatened with 10 years in prison decides to inform on their comrades. Nor would we want to imply that whatever forms of altruism, libidinal passion, death drive, or need for recognition motivates those who inhabit radical milieus do not exist among others as well. We talk here of distributions and primacies. But the historical evidence is clear that the vast majority of people participating in a revolution do so because of the deeper motives described above. And in what follows, a desire for safety, for increased well-being, autonomy from themselves and their intimates, and will withdraw their support if they see nothing of the sort on the horizon. The problem is that the organized minority takes its own motives and its capacity for sacrifice, discipline, self-abnegation as evidence of the structure of motivation in general, and as such will frequently turn to pedagogical or pastoral supplement in order to compel the support of the larger revolutionary mass and install in them its own motives. That's why revolutionary organizers, you know, don't understand why people aren't motivated by a kind of ideological commitment to the revolution that drives them and is willing to kind of, you know, make them do the things that they do. As I argue in the pages that follow, this is bound to fail and in fact sets in motion a number of counter-revolutionary processes. We therefore need a better theory of revolutionary motives. For most of the 20th century, fatalism was supposed to provide that theory. Anton Panikowicz and Paul Maddock demonstrated how the organizations that resulted from voluntarist projects would, during non-revolutionary conjunctures, either be destroyed or integrated into capitalism. The emergence of any meaningful struggle would always seem spontaneous from the vantage of the pastors and the pedagogues. Since it emphasized the futility of the projects and interventions of the active minority, fatalism provided a counter to the voluntarists who insisted on the crucial role of their own education or leadership. But this leaves open the question of what happens during revolutionary conjunctures. It is one thing to counsel non-intervention during quieter moments, but another thing altogether to do so during revolutionary ones, when not only the success of the revolution seems at stake, but when suffering and death are either present or imminent. As the pure distillates of the fatalist position, Monsieur Dupont, the uniplural authors of Nihilist Communism, recognize this problem and attempt to find something for the fatalist pro-revolutionary minority to do when it goes down. The answer, disable the voluntarists. In revolutionary conditions, the fatalist minority will be called upon to actually go against much of the revolutionary communist and anarchist milieu. That's a quote from them. There is certainly some truth here in that the attempt by some fraction of the revolution to seize power and begin to lead the revolution will need to be contested vigorously by a revolution within the revolution. But fatalists, such as Monsieur Dupont, are in a sense the weird twins of the voluntarists, relying on a view of the masses of ordinary proletarians as fragile, easily manipulated, diverted, or betrayed, even if capable of spontaneous revolt. Monsieur Dupont lacked the courage of their convictions. If the working class is truly capable of organizing itself and directing its own actions on the basis of motives internal to it, then it is also capable of critically evaluating and rejecting the leadership or education offered. If one believes, as the theory of motives I will develop leads one to believe, that revolutions and the revolutions within revolutions are against counter-revolutions are produced by proletarians acting on the basis of motives internal to them and by way of innate critical endowments, then intervention as such is no longer a problem. Indeed, one no longer needs to argue futilely does a dedicated minority sit on its hands. Rather, one can articulate the ways in which the kinds of things this minority does can either hinder or help the unfolding of the revolution. One can distinguish ultimately between two types of intervention, vanguardist and adventurist. The vanguardist seeks to control, lead, and shape proletarian action through pastoral and pedagogical intervention, and as such, sets in motion counter-revolution. The adventurist, however, engages in self-directed action that seeks to facilitate the conditions under which the vast majority of people will decide that going in the direction of the revolution, of communism, means satisfying their materialist motivations. So I'm trying to, recuperate the notion of adventurist no longer as an insult, but as a kind of positive descriptor. This may mean expropriating capital. Sean really hates that. This may mean expropriating capitals and turning them over to people so that they can meet their needs, engaging in defense of the revolution from capitalist counterattack, or subverting the attempt by revolutionary factions to establish leadership, or any number of other communist measures. The point is that the purely negative theorization that the fatalists offer is inadequate. People will choose among positive actions, not among action or inaction. We can only evaluate positive actions on the basis of an adequate theory of motives. Just one more paragraph. I know I'm going a little bit long. The theory of motives matters then because it is the basis for action by those who have transcended, always partially and for the moment, materialist motives and begun to act on the basis of their commitment to the cause of reform, revolution, or struggle. Theory is always the product of history, of struggle as it is reflected on by those directly and distantly concerned. Abstracted from immediate struggles as it may be, this essay reflects the ongoing self-examination of the activist and radical milieu as it worries about its own existence and its relationship to the masses of proletarians who would be necessary for any revolution. If the pedagogues and authoritarians wildly overstate the importance of such activists, the fatalists wildly understate it. One attempts to arrogate to this group a power that it can never have. The other engages in perpetually abortive fantasies of the self-abolition of this group. Consider this essay an attempt to cut diagonally across both positions, neither arguing fallaciously for the utter insignificance of the active minority, nor attributing to it some fictional burden of leadership. Thanks.
This text is called From Desert to Oasis in 5 Years, and it's our 5-year plan to build a party to suppress the economy. It's not really true. Our goal of this text is to renew debates in revolutionary theory for our time. In the past, in the period of the workers' movement, revolutionaries had both some conception of what communism meant and also some insight into what the revolution that would take them there would look like. That grounded militant action both in struggles when they happen and in the lull periods between struggles. Political tendencies then kind of formed around opposed conceptions of what the revolution that would unfold towards communism would mean, and that informed debates around organization, strategy, and tactics. None of the positions of the 19th or 20th century are viable for us any longer, but we don't seem to have a clear alternative to put forward instead. Without clarifying basic positions on what communism means and what revolution means today, debates within our pro-revolutionary milieus fail to develop, positions fail to clarify, and tendencies fail to form coherently and to evolve. And so because we want to get to some conception of how to get organized today, what we should do as, you know, Marxists or communists or anarchists, we need to kind of begin by developing a conception of revolution and what a revolutionary overcoming of our society would look like. So that's what we're trying to get at in this talk. The point here isn't to convince anyone that our view of revolution is correct, but rather to start a debate that would lead to the clarification of a set of different positions. So if you don't agree with us, you know, we invite you to explain your own position on these questions and why you adapt it, with the goal of we want to contribute to this text of building a kind of ecosystem of different political tendencies that all have some kind of orientation towards revolution. Because if we don't, have an orientation towards some conception of revolution that then disciplines the activity we're doing now, we end up with kind of a fairly arbitrary set of decisions about what we do and don't do when we get organized. So that's the kind of goal of this text. I'll kind of give a brief overview of it and then hopefully, you know, save more time for discussion and get into some more depth. So in 1905, you know, I'm at historical materialism, so I have to talk about the Russian Revolution for at least 2 minutes. So there's a moment in 1905 where the masses in Russia kind of rush far ahead of what revolutionaries had thought was possible. They attempt an insurrection, it fails, but it then reorients debates amongst the Second International, amongst anarchists around the mass strike, this kind of rolling wave of strikes that takes place across at least Europe and Asia, and certainly in Latin and North America. And what ends up happening is sometime, you know, this from 1905 on, this kind of staggering sequence of struggles takes place that after World War I does erupt in this wave of revolution that spreads throughout the continent. And in a sense, so, you know, that obviously failed, but it shows that social revolution is possible. Our wager with this text is that today we're similarly living through a cycle of struggles that you could date with the economic crisis or with 2011, in that struggles unfold discontinuously, there's periods of really intense activity, there's periods of lulls, but over the course of a sequence, struggles tend to develop.